This podcast is presented by Hannover Messe, your leading event for industrial AI.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of our Industrial AI podcast. My name is Robert Weber, and it's a pleasure to talk to
Peter Sieber. Good morning, good afternoon, good night, good something to you, Robert, to everybody, to all you listeners.
Thank you, Peter. I'm back from holiday. What have I missed?
What have you missed? Oh, there's a couple of things I can share with you. Should I start?
Yes. I have no news, Peter. I was on holidays. Yes.
Actually, you did prepare part of our AI in the Alps as well, but you can talk about that later if you want to. Yep. Multimodality. Yep. Not sure how new that is, but I picked it up. So from LLMs to MMMs is as I suggested, yeah. Or should I say M&Ms? You know, in complete words, it means, you know, we've been talking, you know, LLMs for such a long time, large language models, and we're going to continue to do that. But maybe we're not going to continue to call them LLMs, you know. Maybe they're going to be multimodal, multimodal models. So forget the L for language, no L for language, right? And then I suggested it sounds very much like M&Ms. M&Ms, we don't have them where we live, I believe, although not sure on the German market where I'm from, we did have them. I think we called them maybe like treats or something like that with double E. Anyway, those are those small chocolate beans,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, there you go. It was actually Rasmus, Rasmus Rothe. He's the one of the Merentix co-founders.
Yes.
He made me aware of an article by Chris Ola. He is the co-founder of Anthropic. And by the way, Anthropic, they are the ones. That is new. That is news that you missed. They are those that, in the time that you were having holiday, overtook ChatGPT in the chatbot arena.
Okay.
We talked about the chatbot arena last week. If you want to know more about it, it's where humans like Robert and I and many other people go, and you don't see which two chatbots you're using. And then after you say, like, the left one, the right one better, or they're the same, whatever, yeah, then you see it. So in the meantime, so Anthropic, Claude, one of the Claude LLMs is 1 or 2 points above GPT. So like in the same category, right? Now he says multimodality is the next frontier in AI. So get yourself up to speed with where we are. Traditional AI systems often rely on single modal data input, which can limit their understanding and interaction with the environment. Multimodal AI, however, synthesizes information from different sources, right, enabling more nuanced interpretation. This will improve AI systems across all areas of application. Now, that fits perfectly, I think, with Jan LeCun's point. I think the first time where I saw it was that 2 weeks ago on, you know, Lex's podcast with him. I didn't finish it, although what Jan was saying in the first 5 minutes was so, I mean, there were so many good things in it. And one of the things that he was saying there, like in 4 years, a child has seen, you know, 50 times more data than the biggest LLMs today. I can't go into the details. That's not important. But that's exactly the same what he was saying, right? He was saying, you know, we need to be careful, not think that, you know, LLMs is going to be the future. And that's what this is all about. Did he say, I believe so, text is simply too low bandwidth and too scarce a modality to learn how the world works. Now, personally, I believe that we have been gathering multimodal data for many years in our industrial environment, right? So originally, I guess for what, 50 years, that was maybe flat only. You know, we had always numeric sensor data, temperature, pressure, widths, lengths, et cetera, et cetera. I think we've been doing that for 50 years. And then vision has come in, or maybe there was another one, I'm not sure. But vision, I guess, you know, especially for quality control, has been around for again, I guess, maybe 25 years, has been pixel-based. You know, there was this this one podcast that I did, I believe, in German, was 3 years ago. We talked about exactly how we're changing from original pixel-based vision towards probability machine learning-based. So my view is that in our industrial environment, we are very well prepared for moving towards multi-model. So combining, for example, end-of-the-line quality check images with any kind of flat data, I call it flat, numerous data, that we have taken maybe 10 minutes earlier somewhere in the production line. You know, if we can somehow combine it. So if you, dear listener, working on some kind of multimodal industrial solution, I want to talk about it in our podcast, please let us know.
A note from my side, because Johannes Brandstedt has already talked about multimodal models when it comes to simulation. And he said they play a crucial role when it comes to AI and simulation. I think it was 2 or 3 episodes in our archive when at the end at the podcast, Johannes spoke about this kind of models.
That is so good. That's so good that you know that explicitly. And it's so interesting because Johannes is going to be with us exactly where you were. So he's going to be with us in the Alps, right?
Yes, Johannes will be in the Alps and Sebastian Lehner will be in the Alps. We will talk about simulation and AI. And we will also talk about the AI Act. We will have a special group on the AI Act. And then we have, of course, our dear friend, Professor Dr. Marco Huber, and he will talk about real industrial AI use cases. I'm really looking forward. I talked to Yoshi last week about the dinner and what kind of hike we will do this year. And yeah, we planned everything. Yeah.
Oh, looking forward to it. Oh, but that is so good. That is so interesting. That means that in the simulation track, we're going to be most certainly talking about exactly moving towards or just doing already multimodality. But then again, thinking, having said that, as I just suggested, if you, dear listener, you know, let us know, because I'm not, maybe we are already doing this one way or the other, but maybe not in the sense that it was meant in the combination with the models, with the foundation models. I do not believe that. And that is, I then assume, what Johannes is probably going to be talking about.
Yes, exactly. What else do you have?
LLMs, which then soon are going to be MMMs, right? For industrial control. There's a paper from, I'm going to try to pronounce their names correctly, Lei Song, Chuheng Zhang, Li Zhao, and Zhang Bian. From the names, you can already imagine that they are from Asia. Yes, they're from Asia. They're from Microsoft Research Asia. And I was referred to a paper by Mehmet Merzhangöz. I hope I say that correctly again. You know, we had him, he's the ABB reader, Imperial College. We published the interview with last week. There was a lot of discussion, and that coincided with, you recall also, the Aramco. Aramco is probably the world's largest oil company, right?
Yeah, a lot of Saudi Aramco guys interacted with your LinkedIn post, I think.
Yeah, there was a lot of discussion, and that's why I bring it up as well. So they announced the world's first industrial foundation model, right? And that was the words, right? And you know, again, referring back to our conferences, we started probably, from my feeling, 2 years back, talking about the need for an industrial foundation model. And I'm completely certain that we're going to be talking about it again this time, so this summer. And yes, as you say, it drove quite some discussion. There was a question put forward if this was only a PR stunt or whatever. Either way, I've never thought it like that. I thought, sure, I mean, this company has money, you know, they can put it wherever they want it. And why would they not be doing that? So, I mean, and having said that, I do put certain borders for myself to what I'm willing to put time into. You know, Robert, and some of our listeners know quantum computing. You know, I expect it's going to be great. I'm perfectly sure about that, but I'm not going to invest time. It's your topic as far as the Industrial AI podcast is concerned, right?
But I understand the guys who criticize you, because in the text there was hardly anything.
Oh, yeah, there was no detail, yeah.
Yeah, this was really a PR message, but yes, the discussion went then very crazy, I think.
Yeah, and I do want to continue on that. So, and then again, your AGI, you know, artificial general intelligence, that as per an algorithm that is ever going to be capable of deciding to become autonomous. I love reading about it, you know, Asimov, you know, seeing movies, iRobot, perfect. The moment when there's, you know, 10,000 robots standing in the room and the one robot is looking to the left, right. It's a wonderful moment. I think that's perfect. But I do not personally put any time into that because I don't believe into that. Now, but having factories or plants autonomously orchestrated by LLMs, by MMMs, as we know in the meantime, I say, why not? And yes, exactly. That was the discussion. And I agree with you. There was no details behind it. That doesn't mean that they are not doing it. I mean, yeah, I think, I mean, it's a cultural thing. I mean, isn't there this big, I'm going to be in the United States soon. Isn't there this big difference where we have a lot of guys, women from the European, specifically German market, where all these hidden champion companies typically are very modest and more closed, I would say, because they have such great technology and they only want to share it when it's perfectly ready, you know, and maybe they take another year or two. And maybe that's the same here in this case with, is that the Arabic culture? Is that the correct way of saying it?
Yeah.
So I don't know. It doesn't mean that if they're announcing it, could be that they're not completely ready or not, or that they're completely ready. I don't know that. Now, anyway, so this paper.
The paper about the LLM in the industrial control.
Exactly. Pre-trained LLM models for industrial control is about exactly that. It's about foundation models possessing rich prior knowledge obtained from pre-training with inter-skill corpus. You know, same thing we always talked about. And we said, you know, sure. I mean, the internet is the internet and there's a little bit of industrial there relatively, but no. And what they do, they take, I'm not sure I pronounced that correctly. I went extra to YouTube. I think it's called HVAC, heating, ventilation, air conditioning, a building control as an example to examine the ability of GPT-4 as the controller. Now think about that. Now, we have been talking, and you like talking about these, the gray boxes. And here we're talking about, you know, a piece of software, GPT-4. And we know what GPT-4 is as an example of an LLM as a controller. So they're going to look at how well can GPT-4 control HVAC? How well does it generalize? A couple of other questions. Now, in general, they found that GPT-4 achieves the performance comparable to reinforcement learning methods with a few samples. Now, I am not saying that that means that already today we can have a large language model, you know, orchestrating a chemical plant.
Sure.
That's not the point. But they're showing that it can today very well, you know, control an HVAC. Yeah, that's easy. The point is, if we have control and we can control through a large language model, then maybe in 5 or 10 years, or I don't know, at some point in time, we're going to be able to do more. I'm certain about that.
And we put the paper in the show notes. I think everybody's interested in this paper.
Exactly. And actually, so I'm preparing a presentation for, it's called the Connected Plan Conference. I'm going to be there and I'm going to be speaking in Houston. They call themselves the energy capital of the world. And my topic is going to be that I'm actually going to have two topics, but one is going to be towards autonomous plants. You know, I liked that topic a lot, you know, proposed actually from the discussion with Mehmet. But if you, dear listeners, have anything in that area, just please share with me as well.
So next news, Peter.
Subsymbolic and symbolic, to be united.
Oh, yeah.
it's related. It's all related together. As always, there's another paper. It's called Symbolic AI, a framework for logic-based approaches combining generative models and solvers. The guys, I think they're all guys. Yeah, in this case, Marius Constantin Dinu, Claudio Leo Vianu Condrei, Markus Holzleitner, Werner Zellinger, and Sepp Hochreiter.
Oh.
Is he going to join us for a beer sometime at AI in the Alps as well or not?
Yeah.
So Symbolic AI enables the seamless integration of generative models with a diverse range of solvers by treating the large language models as semantic parsers. On this topic, I'm still looking for the common denominator. I'm contacting a number of people. I talked to Franziska Schaefer and actually had a reply yesterday from Jupiter Baku Keu. They are both based, I believe, at the, is it a technical university where you still are dealing, preparing in Nuremberg? Are you still there or not?
No, I'm not in there, but there's two. There's the University for Applied Science, and then there is a new technical university in Nuremberg. There's a new one.
Oh, right. But I think it was the one that where you are. Is it Georg Ohm, I believe, right?
Yes.
I think they're both there, yeah. And they have co-authored another paper, Automated Reasoning and Knowledge Inference on OPC UA Information Models.
Oh, right.
So this topic is all about ontology. And as you know, so you and I, we do, in addition to the industrial AI, we do the OPC Foundation.
Yes, exactly.
And because OPC UA is one of those technologies that has an implicit information model, it has all the information on top. And that's the other thing I will be doing there. And I'm really very much looking forward to.
Perfect. Your last news, Peter, and then we switch to the main part.
Very good. Yeah, it has nothing to do directly. It's more a very high-level topic. There's Peter Gostev. For those of you that want to follow him, it's G-O-S-T-E-V. He's the head of AI at Moonpig. He suggests humor understanding as a benchmark for LLMs. Now, that's very good. What he says, you know, he says humor understanding is something that still sets GPT-4 apart. You know, he tested it alongside Claude. There is Claude, that is the Anthropic large language model, right? And Gemini. And he says Gemini was completely hopeless. Claude was impressive sometimes, but GPT-4, 9 out of 11, was capable of explaining a human joke. Now, he says, he gives a couple of reasons why he believes it's interesting. You know, it's more on the side, as I say. It's not directly for us in the industrial AI environment, but it's more like the big picture of what can LLMs do for us. He says, number one, there's no direct training data. You know, nobody is writing explanations of jokes. So the LLMs cannot memorize something, right? And he says it requires an understanding of the culture. I just mentioned culture, you know, German, American, maybe Arabic culture. And there's 100,000 other different cultures, right? And it needs a kind of understanding of the culture. I think he's from the UK, and the jokes he was giving them were probably British jokes, which, as we know, are completely different from, for example, German jokes, right? Now, there's one, two other reasons that I'm going to share. And he says, before you ask, no, I don't think it's a massively important capability, but that's why it makes it an interesting benchmark. Nobody would bother trying to overfit on it. And I think it's a decent measure of emerging capabilities that nobody would train for.
Interesting. And we come back to the industrial sector because we switch now to the main part with Dr. Julian Feinauer. And we will talk about time series, databases, and an AI node. So it's no LLMs. We are focusing now on time series in the main part.
Back to time series, the basis of whatever we do in industrial.
Back to time series, yes.
And I may assume, just quickly thinking, fine looking in my brain, but that's probably going to be the case for the next, you know, whatever, 10, 20, 30, 40 years. It's very difficult to imagine that we're going to change this idea of, you know, we have technology and we're checking every millisecond whatever is happening in the plant, in the production line, right? So, okay, very much looking forward to listen to Julian. Julian is a great guy and a great listening to him.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Peter. It was a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Talk to you soon again, Robert. Hello and a nice day to you, dear listener. Bye-bye.
Bye. It's a pleasure to talk to Dr. Julian Feinauer, the technical director of Time Echo Europe. Julian, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning, Robert.
Good morning. We want to talk about Apache IoT DB and AI Node. But before we start, please introduce yourself briefly to the listeners, Julian.
Hello, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Julian. And I like databases. That's the reason why I'm here. I think I was already in a podcast with Apache IoTDB and talked a bit about time series databases. Apache IoTDB is an open source project, and I'm a long time committer and PMC member there. And 2 years ago, we started a company, Time Echo. We are where we started to provide professional support and enterprise features for based around Apache IoTDB, so to say.
Can you please summarize for us what is Apache IoTDB, maybe in 5 sentences?
Yes, Apache IoTDB is an open source time series database focused on handling a lot of data. So time series database is a pretty new kind of database focused on time series. So coming from sensors, IoTDB, IoT applications. And there are many products out there. And IoTDB is one of the younger databases, which has incredible performances in case of really many data points. So thousands of devices and millisecond sampling rates and things like this.
What is the unique selling point, or not, it's not a selling point because it's an open source project, but what is so special with Apache IoTDB?
Later, we will talk about a really, really cool feature. So far, I would say it's 2 things. One is the memory footprint, hardware usage. It's excellently fitting for edge devices because it stores data extremely efficiently and really needs very, very few resources for what it does. And the second thing is performance. From what we know, Apache IoTDB is fastest in many benchmarks we did. It has the best performance over all databases, which really only matters, I would say, if you have lots and lots of data.
So it's very good for industrial applications, right?
Right. I mean, it's called Apache IoTDB. So we call it the IoTDB native database. But of course, we have many, many use cases in the IIoT area, so industrial use cases. Coming from managing fleets of vehicles, which send telemetry data, up to having complete plants recorded. And even this is one of the coolest cases, I would say, a nuclear power plant.
Oh, whoa, whoa, whoa. That's critical infrastructure. Oh, wow, whoa. That's very, very difficult to handle, right?
Yes. And there are many reasons why this is an interesting case. And especially we are dealing with, I think, 13 protocols where data comes in, and it's over 86,000 different metrics that are monitored, partially with nanosecond level sampling rate. So it's, yeah, incredible.
And in Europe, you're partnering with Bosch Rexroth, right? You are part of the Control X world, and you're partnering with Bosch, right?
Yes. As I said, IoTDB has this, from my perspective, very nice feature that can use it on constrained devices at the edge. It also has a built-in sync mechanism where you can say, well, I run one instance at an edge device, and I run a bigger instance somewhere centrally in my plant, for example, and have the sync mechanism. And one way to do this is device with the Control X approach, where you can install IoTDB as an app directly on the Control X controller, basically, and then store data locally and then possibly sync it back to a central instance.
So our podcast is not called Data Business, it's called Industrial AI. We need to talk a little bit about time series, machine learning, and AI. You published, I think, 2 or 3 weeks ago, a new, what is it, an app or an add-on? It's called AI Node. What is it and why you launched that?
Yes, and this is the point where I have to be a little bit careful, because now we're kind of leaving Apache IoTDB space and we start talking about Time Echo DB. Because, I mean, as I initially said, one thing we do at Time Echo is provide support, professional support, helping you configure things right.
For the open source project.
For the open source project, yes. But we are also starting to create our own distribution, I would say. That's not unusual in open source world, I would say. And the new AI node we just launched is also at the moment an exclusive feature of the Time Echo DB.
To make it clear, yeah, you have to pay for it.
This disclaimer, sadly, you have to pay for it. Yeah, so what is it? I mean, it's called AI node, which means AI and node.
That's it.
That's it, yes. So what does the node in there do? I mean, AI is, might be clear for most of the listeners. What does the node do? Many modern database or also other data-heavy systems consist of nodes, which means you do not run it on one computer, but you run it on many computers. And on each instance, you run a node. Mm-hmm. That's what it's called. And this is also true for IoTDB. So traditionally, we have two types of nodes. We have config nodes holding metadata, and we have data nodes. And to parallelize your load and to improve performance, you can just start new nodes over and over and over again. So you can have 10 computers running 10 nodes on them. And then data is distributed between them, and then computation is distributed between them. When I say computation, it's normal queries. If you want to query a time series database, you might have millisecond level data for the last year, but you say, well, I want one data point per day. Only average value or min and max value for each day or stuff. And this is a heavy computation containing billions of points that runs then in the cluster. And nowadays, many applications take the time series data and put it in an AI model. To predictions, anomaly detection, many, many things.
Time series annotation, yeah.
Yes. And this is something, there are two ways, probably, or two scenarios. One scenario is you put the data in a database, and at the same time, you run it through a model for each new data point, and then you store the result in the database again. One way. Then the other one could be you just store the data in a database, you run through the model, and then do something with the results directly. Check if you trigger something, trigger an alert or another action, whatever. And usually when you want to do such a scenario, then you have to set up the database, of course. And then you have to set up the AI model, of course. And then you have to have some kind of service which either takes data from the database whenever new data arrives and then puts it to the AI model and later back. Or you have an infrastructure where you get the new data point centrally and then distribute it to both database and AI model. And as we know nowadays, training an AI model is one thing, but deploying an AI model and then keeping it in production is another thing.
Yes, absolutely.
That also needs to be done. And this is the reason why we came up with this concept of the AI node. The idea was, well, we have this database and data is in there already. And we have an SQL-like language where we can say, well, take this data point or run this data point through this function with normal functions. What if we could just deploy the model also in the database directly? And just tell the database, well, take this data, run it through the model, and store the results somewhere. No need to leave the database.
How do you do that?
Yes, and this is the idea of the AI node, basically. So what we do internally is the AI node also runs in your cluster or on your hardware. You can run it on the same servers or on different servers, probably with more GPU and memory. And then internally, you have a complete set of commands for the model management. So the first step, of course, is you need a model. We come with some standard models, default models for the AI node, things like Arima that we can always do on time series. But you could easily train your own model. I mean, of course, it needs to be a model suitable for time series.
Sure.
So the input is always the number of time series that are going in there. Is it only one time series? Is it five? Is it 10? And the second dimension is the number of data points that go in there. Because usually in this discipline, you do not put one data point, but a history.
Yes.
The last 100, last 1,000, whatever. So first step is you set up a model like this and you train the model on your with your normal workflows, I would say. At the moment, we're heavily focusing on PyTorch models as a side note.
Why?
But at the moment, this is pretty popular. I mean, I'm pretty sure other frameworks will be supported in the future as well. But this is the first approach because this is currently, I would say, heavily trending. I don't know what's your impression.
Yes, I think it's like that. I'm not surprised that you're using PyTorch, yeah.
Yeah, and then the next thing is you copy the model somewhere where your nodes can reach it. And then we start with management commands. We have management commands for the database where you can just say, well, load this model. Recognize this model, load this model, and then you give metadata, like what I said, the dimensions of the data that goes in, the dimension of the data that goes out, things like this. That's basically it. Then your AI node knows the model. And then you can start doing simple queries with a special command, which is called call inference.
Okay.
So you can just say, select this data from this time series, call inference, and bam.
That sounds for me that it's a mixed up from an maybe MLOps pipeline and AutoML tool, or am I wrong?
Well, MLOps, I would certainly agree.
Mm-hmm.
AutoML, I'm not certain.
But it helps you to manage your data and building models, right?
At the moment, we're mostly focused on inference.
Okay.
Not so much on the training part. So what you say, it's totally right. And that's a pretty neat idea to say, well, we also probably want to integrate training steps. Because, I mean, what do you need for training? Data. What do you have in the database? Data. And especially if you go then towards the AutoML direction where you say, well, that's all you need. The rest we will figure out by ourselves.
Yep.
This would be a neat approach. I'm not 100% certain. And we have to think through this. I'm not 100% certain because training sometimes is special and you use special infrastructure. I mean, in many situations, you can rely on CPU for inference because it's okay. For training, you can never do CPU. And in many real-world cases, especially in the industry, you're relying on CPU inference because you have no GPUs in the standard hardware that you have, the server racks and stuff. There's no GPU in it. But this is would be a very interesting idea for the future, probably, to say, well, I just give you this data and with the AutoML approach, just fit something. But at the moment, we're focused on inference.
Okay. So how much faster am I then?
What are two dimensions? Setup-wise, you're definitely faster because you don't need to care about the setup of the pipeline, of the ML things, operations, monitoring, and whatever. Data-wise, I've no concrete measurements. I mean, the good thing you get for free is that all the communication between the data node where the data is and the AI node where the AI model is all done internally. You just don't care about it. So usually you should be pretty fast because data goes directly between those two services. In an extreme case, they're even on the same computer. So I would say you will certainly be faster, 20%, 30%, whatever. But I think that the main advantage is the ease you get from it in certain scenarios. I just had yesterday a discussion about if integration over the database is coming back. So many years ago, in a classical web application, you did integration via database. So all services wrote to the database, and this is where we all took our information from. This was the central part. And this is not true anymore because we're doing message-based integration or sending messages around, things like this. But with ideas like this, that more and more features come back into the databases, the database can become, once again, the central part of your application, so to say. And this is not only true for IoTDB. Other databases also experiment with adding features, triggers directly in the database, continuous queries that already do calculations.
Is that what customer wants, that it comes together again?
Once again, I would say depends. I mean, I would say totally depends on the use case, on the scenario. I mean, on one hand, it makes small deployments way easier. Because they save a lot of time on not having to set up separate systems. On the other hand, also in bigger scenarios, it just sometimes helps you to keep things sane and to only focus about one big system and not seven small systems.
So your focus branches is machine building companies, automation companies, or which companies you want to tackle with that?
I would say, I mean, my main focus is production.
Okay. The whole manufacturing.
The whole manufacturing industry. I mean, we also have scenarios, as I said, like fleet management, telemetry data management, we have connected car cases and connected machineries, like big cranes, machines like that. But a lot of things happened in the, especially in the production industry. So there's one approach that my colleague Chris, Christopher Dutz, is working on, is building up a small and simple MES system, manufacturing execution system, basically built on top of IoTDB, where we ingest data, we have triggers, we can send out events, we can store the data, we do calculations on it. Yes.
Please, once again, make it clear. You are using built-in algorithms, right? So you have, I don't know, for time series forecasting, anomaly detection, and you using the built-in algorithms, and the user can use these algorithms, right?
This is the first step. Yes, we ship it with built-in algorithms, but you can also deploy your own models.
Okay.
So if you train an anomaly detection model or already have one in your application and say, well, probably the data gets more and more, I need a time series database, and then I need a pipeline to do the AI thing. But then you could push everything in.
So what is the competitors? What are the competitors doing? They are going the same way?
That's an excellent question. I mean, the time series database market is quite complex for me because I mostly focus on the industrial area, because there are many different time series databases for different applications. There are many time series databases for the, I don't know if you can say marketing area, like recording sequences of clicks of users visiting web pages.
Digital marketing, yeah.
Yes, this area. And historically, time series databases came from monitoring server farms because there you also have CPU and memory and all temperature, all these things. And I would say for the first case, for this marketing thing, I guess ML also plays a major role because you want to, I don't know, customer segmentation and things like this. And for the server business, probably not so much because there you mostly have static alerts. I am not aware of another database having such a feature, which does not necessarily mean that there is no database having this feature. I mean, it's also for us still a bit of an experiment, I would say, on how customers react to this feature. I think it's very cool to play around with it. But of course, a customer could also say, makes the login a bit higher. The question of philosophy, if you say, well, I want a modular system where I get this component from A and this component from B and always take best-in-class systems and glue them together. Or if I say, well, I take a one-size-fits-all.
So what do I have to do if I want to try out your AI node and Apache IoTDB?
Well, if you want to try out Apache IoTDB,
go to GitHub and download.
To GitHub and download the code. If you want to try out the AI node, I think I have to say a sentence that I probably never said in my life before, and I'm not very keen on.
You have to pay.
You have to contact sales.
Okay.
So you have to shoot me
for our listeners. Julian is my open source hero when it comes to industrial applications, and he never said something like you have to contact the sales.
In fact, I'm doing a talk today about IoTDB and the AI node, and it's the first talk where I cannot start with the sentence I do not want to sell you something.
I
still don't want to, but I mean it's part of. Well, I guess you have to pay money if you want this.
But from a technical point of view, what do I have to do?
Well, from a technical perspective, you have to, if you have a deployment of IoTDB, then you have config nodes and you have data nodes, and then you have to spin up some AI nodes. That's just a regular bash script that you have to spin up in your infrastructure, setup of 10 minutes, and then you're already there. Then you can start with the built-in models. And if you want to add your own models, then, I mean, you have to see if they are ready in the suitable way with input dimension, output dimension, little things like this. And then you could just deploy them. As I said, you copy the model somewhere where all your AI nodes have access, some shared drive, or in Kubernetes would be volume claim or something, mounted to all your AI nodes. And then there's one command which says register the model in the AI nodes, and then it's there. And then you can start writing queries with it.
Wow. What are your next steps with Apache IoTDB and also with your AI node product? So you already mentioned maybe AutoML, something like this could be an option. What else?
I mean, one big part, as we already learned in this discussion, is, I mean, we need to get feedback. Mm-hmm. This is a very young feature. It was officially announced in December last year on the IoTDB World Summit. Extremely new feature, and we have to roll it out and discuss with customers what they think and how this could be used, and just get real-world feedback. Things like what we discussed, is PyTorch enough for now? Or customers say, well, we have this TensorFlow notes here and things like this. Then we have to learn how customers want to use it and what we can improve there. And other thing is, as discussed, probably we can consider doing training steps in there or helping with training a model in a way that we can prepare the data in the right way or things like this. And regarding IoTDB, I mean, the last two releases were pretty minor. We added some features, a lot of management, infrastructure, operations, things. We pretty recently released a very new version of the cluster module, which now helps to build even bigger clusters in a very simple way and to scale the cluster very dynamically, which was not possible with the old cluster module. Besides that, there's this trend to adding more and more features to a database. As I said, this is more of the, perhaps the database will once again become the central part We have things like continuous queries, which just mean you can set a rule which says whenever a data point comes in here, do this calculation to calculate a, I would say, virtual data point and store it there. We have pipes where we can say, well, whenever this happens, send data out to this other system. We have triggers where you can say, well, whenever data point comes in, that do this condition, and if something happens, do this and that. So we're working on many features and making it easily possible to have a typical IoT application, but without needing 7, 8, 9 systems.
Let me ask you one question at the end. What do you see on the database market that interests you? Not IoTDB, other database trends you see?
This is a very good question. So generally speaking, the whole scaling thing is still amazing to me. I mean, the big disruption with the so-called NoSQL databases came when the regular relational databases came to a limit because it's very hard to scale them to different nodes. Mm-hmm. Normal database works best on one central node. So the standard approach was just to make the node bigger until we hit the limit. And then there were all these NoSQL databases that made everything more easy, scale. But then we learned that relational databases have all these nice features that the NoSQL databases have not. And we're still somewhere in between. NoSQL database adding more and more features that relational database always had. And on the other hand, relational databases getting more and more ideas on how we can still scale out a bit without losing too much. And then we have this trend of, do you still host a database yourself or do you take one software as a service?
Yes.
Because in a typical...
Is it possible this time, Echo?
Technically speaking, it is possible. At the moment, we do not offer such a service. Okay. This is something we discussed, and probably there is a market for hosted time series databases. But on the other hand, if you look at the general market, you see that a lot of the IoT infrastructures from great providers were shut down this year and last year. So I'm not 100% certain. And also, I mean, many customers do not want to send their data out, especially this part of data. Yeah, so I'm not certain about it. But this is still super amazing for me to see how the NoSQL databases try to be more SQL-like, and the SQL databases learn more and more about NoSQL database or what tricks they could integrate.
Julian, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to talk to you. All the best for you and your product, for your open source project, for the colleagues from the sales department, and for AI Notes.
Thank you very much, Robert. Thanks for having me.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.